fog. As Carl Sandburg said, it comes in on little cat's feet. It has a way of capturing our imagination. It is mysterious and romantic. It also has a history of being deadly. I take a look at the Denora death fog this week. Also, I'll look at a phone booth in the desolate Mojave Desert and how it has been connecting strangers around the world. I'll also examine a most curious haunting that will leave you scratching your head and possibly questioning the nature of reality as we know it. I'm Alan Brill. Welcome to Brilliant, a podcast from the mind of Brill. Warning, it gets dark in here. Howdy, folks. I am so thankful that you decided to turn on the show today. So just settle in, take a break from the real world, and I'll give you a guided tour of some of the weird subjects that make up the library of my mind. Now, the Red Ghost, which I covered in episode 3, it only increased my appetite for tales of camel carnage, and this week I've got another tale of the murderous species. Now, this is covered by several media outlets, but I pulled the following article out of the Fortean Times Book of Strange Deaths. Pamela Weaver was killed by her pet camel at her family's sheep and cattle ranch near the town of Mitchell in Queensland, Australia. It knocked her to the ground, stamped on her head, and lay on top of her. Husband Noel, who gave her the camel as a 60th birthday present in March 2006, returned home to discover her body on 18 August 2007. He had considered buying her a llama or an alpaca, but found they were too expensive. The camel was just 10 months old, but already weighed 335 pounds and had come close to suffocating the family's pet goat on a number of occasions. Mrs. Weaver was in the middle of cooking dinner, and there was a cup of tea on the kitchen table. The camel was wandering loose in the backyard. Many reports said that the camel was trying to mate with Mrs. Weaver, but its behavior is more consistent with seeing off a love rival. "What happened is certainly characteristic of a bull in season," said camel expert Patty McHugh. "That's how they kill their opposition. They pull their legs out from underneath, and they sit on them with their brisket, which is the hard bit underneath their chest." Mr. Weaver, who broke down in tears at his wife's funeral on 23 August, said, "You have to forgive the camel. He loved her very much. She loved animals, rearing everything from goats, kangaroos, emus, rabbits, and the camel." The family agreed that the camel would not be destroyed. Chris Hill, who has been offering camel rides to tourists for 20 years, said camel calves were not aggressive but could be dangerous if treated as pets. He had no doubts the camel's behavior was sexual. Camels aren't pets, y'all, and right now they are racking up the body count. Speaking of treating animals as pets that you probably shouldn't, I believe that this next man rued the day he decided to add this animal to his petting zoo. Eric Slate, 52, died of multiple blunt force injuries, according to Tamara Willer, the chief deputy coroner of Horry County, South Carolina. Slate had been found dead in the kangaroo enclosure of Five Star Farm, a children's petting zoo owned by his brother, which he was known to enter to roughhouse with a kangaroo named Jack. It is believed that the animal got the better of Slate on this occasion and had kicked him to death with its powerful hind legs, although the Horry County Police Department said that the death investigation remains active and ongoing. Despite their size, strength, and propensity for boxing, deaths by kangaroo are surprisingly rare. Although an Australian man was killed by a pet roo in 2022, before that, the last recorded death took place in 1938. This article is out of TheGuardian.com, May 12, 2025, and also the Fortean Times, issue 460 from August 2025. I think this is clearly another case of being too familiar with wild animals that, although somewhat domesticated, can and will kill you, especially if you challenge them to a boxing match. But in this age of investigative prowess and true crime, I think we need to ask the question, is Jack being framed? Was the body dumped there post-mortem? Is there an innocent Rube being accused of murder? For several decades, a solitary booth stood in the middle of the Mojave National Preserve, miles away from civilization. Riddled by bullet holes and carpeted by broken glass, it looked like it had seen better days. It had been placed there in 1948 to service cinder miners, but no one knows exactly by whom. Its only neighbors were desert plants, telephone poles, and, if it was lucky, a passing coyote. Over all those years, it was silent, with only the wind breaking the quiet of the desolate landscape. But then one day, it began ringing. So began the article, A Ghost in the Desert in Route Magazine. From its humble and obscure beginnings, the Mojave phone booth would be catapulted into legend because of the efforts of an Arizona resident named Godfrey Doc Daniels. He was turned on to the existence of the phone booth when he stumbled on a letter to the editor in an unspecified magazine. It was written by a man who referred to himself only as Mr. N. On a map of the Mojave, Mr. N had spotted the icon for a telephone 15 miles from the nearest paved road. This stoked his curiosity, and he drove out into the desert to find it alongside a dirt road and scribbled down its number, 760-733-9969. His curiosity similarly stoked. Doc called the phone booth several times a day during the next month. After he logged so many calls with no answer, Doc began to lose hope when one day somebody picked up the other end of the line. It was a cinder miner named Lorene. They chatted for several minutes, but Doc forgot to ask where exactly the phone booth was located. With a nearly rabid determination, he and a friend managed to track it down. They drove there in a lightning storm and began making calls. Doc created a website where he listed the phone booth's number, and people began flocking to it. Some called their own people from it, but others wanted to connect with people all over the globe. One man camped there for a month and answered over 500 calls. Another old-timer just wanted to share stories from his days as a trucker. Concerns arose over the dramatic increase in foot traffic and its possible impact on the local wildlife. Dave Nichols, a park archaeologist for the Mojave Preserve, said, "It was just attracting too much unwanted attention in terms of litter and detritus and mementos and things that were being left on site. I think that's ultimately why Bell was convinced to remove it." In May of 2000, Pacific Bell and the National Park Service tore it down. In the last phone call it ever received, Lorene's brother chatted with a gentleman from England before heading off to work in a shift in the cinder mine. People still made pilgrimages to the concrete slab, with one journeyer even constructing a tombstone for the booth, showing just how much people connected with this booth that had brought strangers together. The park department eventually removed even the slab and thwarted any attempts to put a plaque where the lone phone booth once stood. I am happy to report, however, that the legend still lives on. On July 31st, 2019, Jared Morgan, a.k.a. Lucky225, acquired the original number and created a system where people can call it and enter a conference call. If you are lucky, you may call it and find someone on the other end of the line, or you may just be casting your voice into the void. That number again is 760-733-9969. I'd say we call it and see what happens.
We're sorry. The number you have dialed has been changed to a conference. Press 0 for the board. Press 1 through 9 for conference.
I guess it wasn't my lucky day. I was a conference call of one. Fortunately, I'm great company. But this phone booth just really captured everybody's imagination and just brought strangers together just to be heard and to connect, and it's a beautiful thing. And go ahead and call it every now and then and have a random conversation with a stranger. You might find you have a lot in common, and the world's a little smaller than we think it is. Fog, it captures our imagination. It obscures the world so that we are forced to conjure images of what may be lurking inside it. In popular culture, video games like Silent Hill, books and movies like Stephen King's The Mist, it's what comes through when a reality is ripped open and another reality bleeds through, ushering in the unknown. It's maddening when it delays flights. It's beautiful and haunting. It's scary and it's romantic, and as it has proven a couple of times in history, it's been fatal. On Tuesday, October 26th, in the year 1948, a thick fog blanketed the steel mill town of Denora, Pennsylvania. Now, fog wasn't an unusual thing for the citizens of Denora. Cold Allegheny Mountain air hit the warm water off the Monongahela River, and it often produced a thick fog. And when you add to that that the steel mill and zinc factory poured out smoke for three solid shifts, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, it was just business as usual for the good folks of Denora. So people thought nothing of this fog that rolled in. They went about their day. People went to work. They got the kids ready, sent them off to school. Business as usual in the small town of Denora. When the sun rose, however, the fog didn't burn off like it usually did. At noon, the streetlights were still on. The fog, it actually became thicker as the day wore on. Townspeople began coughing and gagging. One survivor is quoted as saying, "The smog burned your throat, eyes, and nose. But we thought it was just another day in Denora." Now, Denora was home to the U.S. Steel Zinc Works and American Steel and Wire Mill. And between the two factories, they had 30 smokestacks that lined the river. Now, the two factories, they employed most of the men in town. And every person in town, one way or the other, either supported or factored or profited from the two factories. The people of Denora, they were used to smog. Smog meant jobs and security. You see, memories of the Great Depression, they still lingered in the area. So smog was viewed as just as a nuisance. It was the price a person had to pay for the shot at the American dream. This fog, however, was different. It continued to worsen. It grew thicker and thicker over the course of five straight days. Kids hacked and gagged their way through the thick fog for the Halloween parade on Friday. And on Saturday, they played a football game where no passes were even attempted because the receivers couldn't see the ball in the air. That's how thick it was. It was so thick that the fans couldn't even see the players on the field. The fog began causing uncontrollable coughing and asthma-like symptoms. Now, there were 8 practicing doctors in town, and they ran from house to house urging anyone struggling to breathe just to get the hell out of town. Get out and go any direction. Just leave. Driving visibility was limited to only a few feet, even with your headlights on. On the street, firefighters, they carried oxygen tanks to help kids and the elderly get from place to place. And the ambulances, they could only crawl along at 5 miles an hour with a spotter walking in front, shouting directions back to the driver. And soon, even that was out of the question. Firefighters couldn't see well enough to navigate in the streets. And all this was at midday. One survivor was quoted as saying, "The smog was so bad I couldn't see my own 2 feet." So, this was not a normal fog. What exactly was it? Well, there was a rare weather event called an atmospheric inversion. And it stopped the town's air from circulating out. It was a cap of cold autumn air, and it trapped the hot air underneath. And essentially, it formed a dome. And this dome trapped the carbon monoxide and zinc/lead dust from the town's two factories. In 4 days, people began dying. The doctors turned the small hotel into a hospital overflow. The air wasn't circulating, it wasn't moving, and these factories, the 30 smokestacks, are just pouring poison out into the town. So the people, begged the mill owners, "Hey, just let's shut this down for a couple of days. You're adding poison to it. Let's just knock it off for a couple of days and try to clear this off until this inversion lifts." Very reasonable request, more than reasonable. It's a no-brainer, and they asked the mill owners to shut it down, and so, of course, they refused. Yeah. They claimed it would cost too much money to halt production. Meanwhile, people were dying. By Saturday, the three funeral homes filled up the community center basement and became a makeshift morgue. Finally, the winds and the rain did come, but not before many of the townspeople suffered permanent lung damage. In all, 26 people died as a result of the Norn death fog. Now, the mill owners denied any responsibility, of course. I mean, after all, they can't control the weather. And state and federal investigators descended on the small town wearing their metaphorical white hats. And turns out that instead of metaphorical white hats, it was metaphorical corporate ball caps. That the two extremely influential and powerful companies, they somehow were exonerated of all blame. And the people were furious, and rightfully so. One person was even as quoted as saying, "It was murder. The owners of U.S. Steel should have gone to jail." Yeah, I mean, true, they can't control the weather, but stop pumping poison into the air when the air can't escape. People are dying. You can stand to lose a day's or two's worth of production. You know, price of human life, and you know how high that was back then, I guess. Now, the factories were found guiltless, ultimately. But the tragedy did make national headlines, and it made air pollution a national concern. President Harry Truman called for the first national air pollution conference in 1970. President Nixon created the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, leading to the Clean Air Act. Denora, however, was not the only city to suffer from the death fog disaster. Across the pond in London, an atmospheric inversion caused what came to be known as the Great Smog in 1952. Now, aside from the underground transportation severely limited, you know, ambulances couldn't run, and many people just simply left their cars on the streets. Pedestrians, much like in the Nora, claimed they couldn't even see their feet. What struck me was that indoor plays and concerts were canceled because the audience couldn't see the stage. The original death toll is estimated at 4,000, but the effects of this poison smog were long-lasting, and ultimately the number of deaths caused by the smog is now believed to be closer to 12,000 people. Now, this next case is called The Haunter. It comes from the pages of Paulino's book, Dancing Past the Graveyard. Eno has a unique take on the paranormal involving the multiverse, that there are an infinite number of versions of the world in which we exist, and they all exist simultaneously. And sometimes these worlds bump and rub into each other. They overlap a little bit, and where they do bump into each other, he calls membranes. And sometimes things can come through to our world, and some of these things are malevolent and feed off our energy. These things he calls parasites. But happily, because I'm bummed out after the death fog, this case does not involve a parasite, but it involves a fascinating haunting. Now, in the early 70s, there just weren't too many people investigating the paranormal, certainly not well known for it, not like today. Throw a pebble, you're going to hit a paranormal investigator, and I'm here for it. But, you know, in the early 70s, it's a different story. And a young woman named Jan, she found Paul anyway, and she relayed to him the following story. Jan told Eno that her older sister Pat had always been into subjects like deja vu and reincarnation, and she's always saying things like, "I've been here before." But one day, Jan, Pat, and their two boyfriends, they were traveling down a back road in York, Maine, when Pat began screaming, "Stop, stop, stop the car!" Joey, who was Jan's boyfriend and was driving, was freaked out. He slams on the brakes, and Pat screamed, "Oh my God," and pointed at a white house 50 feet off the road. It had an overgrown front yard. And Pat exclaimed, "I know this house. This is my house." And without any warning, she just jumped out of the car and sprinted up the front yard to the door. startled the three remaining friends. They tore out after her, but they couldn't catch up with her until she's already just pounding on the front door. And as they were dragging her away from the door, it swung open to reveal a woman in her 30s who took one look at Pat, screamed, and stumbled backwards into the house. A man in his 40s replaced her at the door and stood there just gaping at the young people. Pat, she regained her composure and apologized for intruding, but blurted out that she felt like she knew this house. The woman who answered the door, she was still shaking, and the man, who was white as a ghost, declared, "I wouldn't be surprised if you did know this house. It's you. It's haunted by you. Now, for God's sake, please go." Joey took charge of the situation, and he herded the others back to the car, and as they drove away, they could still see the couple watching, just wide-eyed from the front door. And Jan, she told Paul, "We never did find out what it was all about, but it was scary as hell, and Pat's been depressed ever since." Now, this story had Paul's attention, and he was soon on the case. The first thing he did was interview Pat, who told him that she had been dreaming of that house for 2 years. Now, the dream stopped after she encountered the place. "But there were a couple of different dreams about my being in the house. I had one a week, and they almost always stayed with me. In one of the common dreams, she would walk halfway down the stairs, stopping as something she couldn't identify startled her. In another dream, she was in the front yard looking at the house, which is how she recognized it from the road. And in yet another common dream, she stared out of the window watching children, two boys and a girl, playing in the front yard, and she was adamant that the house and the children were hers." She struck Paul as sincere, and even so, he arranged for a thorough psychiatric evaluation at the Institute of Living in Hartford. Next, he had to track down the house. In a stroke of luck, Jan had caught the name Kalinowski on the mailbox, and he managed to track down the address, and he wrote them on October 22nd, requesting an interview with them. And to his surprise, they called him up 3 days later. And the day after Halloween, he pulled up to the house, and immediately he noticed a for sale sign on the front yard. Before he even stepped out of the car, Peter had opened the door. These people were anxious to see him and get some answers. Something was definitely going on here. After they all got settled down, Peter and his wife, Ann, and Peter and Ann, they had no children. They described numerous sightings of a transparent figure they said was the girl at the door, in exactly the same places that Pat had described in her dreams, walking down the stairs, stopping halfway, looking out the window. They see her out in the front yard looking in. Pat, the spectral Pat, would show up at all hours of the day and night, and this is a fascinating point. Pat's dreams only occurred at night when she was asleep, so her apparition appeared even when she wasn't dreaming. The couple said that the stairway apparition seemed to see them, and Peter and Ann, they were just in a state of nearly constant terror, but the apparitions had seemed to stop after the strange visit Pat had played to them. Had made to the place. Now, past test results came back. She was deemed normal and of sound mind. So, how does a ghost of a living person haunt the house? I mean, a couple of things that would come to mind would be astral projection or, you know, out-of-body experience. And these are good theories, and they could answer several questions. But both of them, at least to my mind, they both suffer from the same fatal flaw. See, they saw the apparition of Pat while she was still conscious and in control of her body, not while she was dreaming, not while she was in a fugue state. It seemed to exist independent of that. And also, these theories don't address the children that Pat saw in her dream state, that she knew somehow were her children. Now, it would seem that a parallel world was bleeding through into ours. It was overlapping. A world, a different timeline where the house was Pat's, and a world in which she had three children. I believe that Pat connected with this other self while she was asleep, and they would have shared experiences. I think that the Kalinowskis witnessed the other world briefly phasing into theirs. This makes somewhat sense to me, as much sense as such things can, but then why did the phenomenon stop when Pat visited the house? Like, why would that change things? I don't know. I really doubt we ever will, but a house being haunted by a living person is a darn curious thing, and it's one worth consideration for sure. A really curious haunted house story, a little bit different than normal. Yeah. I'd like to thank you for joining me on this week's tour of the strange wilds of my mind, the weird things that I think about. And, you know, I hope you'll join me again next time. But until then, I wish you well. And please, be careful, because it can get dark out there.